felt at the time that he was leaving Vietnam, and he had very mixed emotions.
Well, what can you say? You put 2 years of your life into a situation, and I never made any secret of the fact that wish for the communist side to win. I never made a point different from my allegiance was essentially to the non-communist nationalist side. And we all knew and recognized that the government, as it was set up at that time, was riddled with all sorts of corruption and horrors and so on and so forth. That doesn't change the fact that this massive effort partly on the part of your own countrymen, a lot of goodwill, a lot of idealism, that really doesn't get much credit today because we lost.
Hold on a second, I think my battery's just done.
Some people have forgotten their own past.
And it won't make any fun. It won't make a seamless story at all because the paper clip doesn't want to work here for a second. Yeah, I know. Well, we're at the end. No, it's just the pause button. That's my usual problem. Okay. Yes.
Well, I would say up until about the middle of 1967, yes, was essentially in concert with
one thing again. Yeah, there it goes. Yeah. Okay, it was in concert with the American effort.
Right. With large reservoir of criticism and dismay.
Replace those banners. Oh, there. But it seems okay, so we'll keep going. But generally, IBS was supportive of the war effort until 1967 or so.
I was kind of uncomfortable with the support of the war. Right. We could essentially be in with the objectives of American policy in Vietnam and yet be dismayed about the war and the way it was going and the destruction and the increasing American involvement. Just Saigon, just full of Americans. I think in 1967 there was really the turning point, and of course that's when the protest. I wrote a long book about this and objected to the way they had done it. I thought it was a betrayal of IBS. Mm-hmm.
For the Domus's letter?
Right. And little subtleties like this weren't given much credence. But the point was not to object to their protest. It was to object to essentially using the name of IBS. That amounted to kind of a coup almost. I was definitely the minority on that. I think pretty much the same thing today. My opinion on that has not changed.
Did Don come to you to ask you to sign the letter when he had a...
Gene Stoltzfus came around. He did a tour of all the Southern Delta stations. And frankly, he kind of waffled on it. He told me one thing and told other people other things. And I felt it was kind of shabby the way they went about it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of tricky. And I just felt that IVS deserved to be more than turned into a propaganda vehicle. Happened.
Yeah. Did you feel that? Well, how do you feel? Why do you feel that? That it I mean, besides, you know, when Don left and resigned and all that,
right.
And then that ended that episode. Did you feel after that it continued to be a propaganda tool?
Well, I think for some IBSers, yeah. I think. Volunteers felt that their main function had become to basically feed him information forever. And, well, John Balaban basically said that in his book, that IVS had decided it was worth much more as a propaganda. My own take on that would be that was not why we were there, that was not what we had signed up to do, and that felt like that they really should leave the organization, or the whole organization should. But, you know, there's obviously, I mean, we were all agonized by the situation. Those nominally in support of the war, or in support of the National Society, or however you want to say. I mean, the war was getting worse and worse all the time. They were bringing in more American troops all the time, B-52 strikes. Up until about 1967, see, the war in the Delta was still a pretty low-level affair.
Mm-hmm.
It was still a guerrilla war. And quite unlike up towards Da Nang and
right.
those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, my own perspective on it was very local. If I had been up in Da Nang around those areas, I might well have had a different perspective. That's part of the IVS thing too, is that you sort of consider the people you deal with and you work with as, in some sense, your constituents.
Mm-hmm.
It was wrenching, and I don't blame Don and Gene and the rest for doing what they did. IVS is one of the few organizations I've ever given my loyalty to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not an organization. Well, there was kind of a betrayal there of trust. A long-range picture of Vietnam and America's involvement, that may mean nothing. But to me personally, it means something.
Mm-hmm.
I have no great wish to rehash, you know, we all did what we thought we had to do based on our own moral standards and political standpoint and all the rest of it. But some of the fellow traveling that occurred afterwards was far in excess of and the refugees, the boat people started streaming out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time,
mm-hmm.
and there were quite a few IVSers there. There was kind of a colony of them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were just, I thought, incredibly heartless. They didn't really care that people were in re-education camps. Their sympathy with the Vietnamese as such had become polarized to the point where, you know, the old corrupt South Vietnamese were just off the radar screen of concern, and that was indecent.
Mm-hmm.
I was there in Washington. Joan Baez and Baird Rustin
mm-hmm.
came and gave a concert. I think it was right at the Lincoln Memorial. You know, giving aid and comfort to the boat people.
Yes, she was one of the
faithful for her. And I thought it was a basic decency and consistency that a lot of people who had sided with the anti-war movement failed to show.
Those who found the war morally repugnant, what was morally wrong was Americans, because they weren't Vietnamese. Their job as Americans was to stop that involvement. And after that, their interest in Vietnam, because their interest in Vietnam, most of the anti-war movement, was to, all they could control was what Americans did. And when Americans got out, it was up to the Vietnamese to resolve their conflict. And all the anti-communist propaganda, it seemed only right that to attack the excesses of the new communist regime when we have years of war, the Saigon regime's own corruption, was blaming the victim. Interesting. No, I'm not. That's not a justification. It's a statement of what David Hunt, who's a historian, has written, a study of what was the anti-war movement's reaction to what happened in Vietnam after the war. Mm-hmm. And most everyone said, see, no bloodbath. Re-education camps? What did you expect? And come on, let's get on with the real problems we have in America that we've been bearing while we've been fighting in the war. So I think there was the interesting thing is you've refocused that on the volunteers. These were people who lived.
Moralists of a certain kind are very selective mm-hmm. about what they choose to moralize about. Mm-hmm. Very inclusions and exclusions. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, though, that not everybody who was on the government side in Vietnam was rotten. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the ones who probably suffered the most in the re-education camps were the ones who stood up for what they believed in mm-hmm. and didn't just cave in and say, yes, I was a just puppet of the Americans.
No, I agree.
Because those were the people. And see, the nature of communism mm-hmm. didn't just change just because it was associated with Vietnamese nationalism. Mm-hmm. Despite all the anti-communist propaganda, the record of communism in the 20th century is not
very good.
Not a very happy one.
No.
For the people who have had to suffer under it. So that's why what you've said about the rationale of mm-hmm. the people who are not going to blame the victims for anti-communism, which was Jean Paul Sartre's big number. Mm-hmm. And it's very pernicious kind of way mm-hmm. to its reality so it fits in with a pure ideological picture.
The argument that can be has been made actually was that the struggle to reunify Vietnam, kind of unique qualities that Vietnamese communism may have had, that the centralization necessary in order to win the war against the United States produce the Communist Party that was capable of doing what it did. Towards, you know, you imagine Ho Chi Minh in 1945 taking over Vietnam. He made arrangements with the French where private property would be respected in the Vietnamese Constitution, that the French would not be, French property would be confiscated, that regular elections would be held. Of course, those things were never, after that, they were never going to happen again.
Well, but look.
And that could be propaganda also.
Well, it's not so much propaganda, it's just, it's kind of a looping mechanism mm-hmm. where you put the best face on mm-hmm. on something intangible that, a counterfactual essentially.
Right.
There, and a counter argument could be made, I don't know if you've read P.J.'s Honey book.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, oh yeah.
Okay, this was one of, I don't know, it came out in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But he essentially argued that there were, especially the Maoist faction in the Politburo up in Hanoi, mm-hmm. was indeed trying to emulate some of the Chinese communist massification. One could even argue that the fact that the French came back and reasserted their hegemony, to use that buzzword, in a way was kind of a prophylactic against the North Vietnamese communists from carrying out some of the more radical features that indeed was
that,
to come
that
around
about
in,
me.
In China.
My own study and reading seems to suggest the opposite, that the Lê Duẩn, for example, is really a creature of the war, and that faction was not dominant, except in relation to the weakness of the Communist Party. That is, the weaker people like Vo Nguyen Giap was on the Politburo, in terms of getting things done, the stronger the China dependency became. Why are we doing this? You know, why are we giving in to China? And he says, the idea is Vietnam not in international isolation. Might have taken a different course. But I think you just said it very eloquently. Why put the best face on the counterfactual proposition? It could equally as well have gone that way anyway. So that's a very astute observation.
Well, I've always been bemused by the fact that Ho Chi Minh was a apparatchik in the common term, all during the 30s. And that was a pure Stalin operation. The sponsors and subsidizers of the American Communist Party, among other things. However, you know, who can say? I mean, God knows, we all wish the French had just said,
yes,
the age of colonialism
is
over. You know, but again, you're talking, you know, that's rewriting history.
That's correct.
And,
yes.
And trying to, it's like saying, go back to the early years of Kennedy's presidency. Vietnam was the cutting edge of the idealist crusade of the new frontier.
Mm-hmm. Or it was something that had to be done anyway because of the old legacy. I mean, Kennedy could not walk away from the anti-communism of the 50s and go to the new frontier. That had to be a part of the new frontier, too.
Well, and he sort of got boxed in by Nixon, not being soft on communism. And, of course, he had his Cuba thing, which his obsession, which it became. It's sort of the same thing that Clinton's in now. He can't take a stand against the military or the intelligence agencies because he just doesn't have any moral standing from their point of view.
Right.
And so he basically gives them whatever they want.
Well, there's a book out on that by Bob Bazzanco about that. It's called Masters of War that talks about how the presidents became essentially part of that, actually colored all of his policies. And actually made them more. I wanted to ask you a question.
Yeah.
After you left Vietnam, you came back as a reporter.
Right.
How did that happen? That's fascinating.
Well, I came back and went up to my mom's place in Montana. I drafted. Because of various reasons, the draft process did not go through.
Okay. They didn't accept your IVS service as alternative service?
While I was there, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the minute I came back, my name shot up to the top of the list.
Yeah. That normally didn't happen, but in places like Montana or Palm Springs, or places that were relatively rural where they had a very small pool, they very often tried to disregard the IVS as alternative service. They just did what they did in your case.
Well, it was my fault because if I'd waited few more months, I'd been over 26. Maybe it would have been a whole year I'd had to stay. But I did. But anyway, I was sitting on a ranch in Montana and knew Vietnamese and, you know, studied it very intently and
it seemed kind of silly to be sitting out there doing nothing, and I didn't have any firm plans about what I wanted to be doing anyway. And, I had known people that were involved in this dispatch. I don't know if you've come across this before. Mm-hmm. Loose bunch of freelancers, essentially. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So I had known people that were associated with that, and I just decided that I would go back and do some reporting, which I did. Now I wrote stuff on the rice trade and some kind of human interest, world class mm-hmm. war correspondent stuff by any means. But I wrote quite a bit and got quite a bit published. But after about 9 months, it just got. I mean, the Americans that you would meet or deal with were becoming much more frustrated and angry and just kind of passive about civilians, the military people. Oh, and the inflation was terrible, so the Vietnamese weren't eating well, and their teeth were bad, and people were gaunt, and essentially, it was pretty obvious that the war was going to come to a bad end. So all the continual battles and all that were just, more and more killing, and it wasn't going to change the outcome, the ultimate outcome. So it got too depressing to deal with, and so I went to Bangkok. I stayed there for a year.
Taught English? Where?
The Royal Thai Naval Academy.
Oh! And when you came back to the States after that, did you, what do you do today? What do you?
I'm semi-retired. Freelance writer, sociologist.
What did you do when you came? Did you come back to the States from Bangkok?
Right. I immediately started graduate school.
In what field?
Sociology.
Sociology. Did do you get an advanced degree? Did you complete?
PhD.
PhD, and you taught?
No, never taught.
Never taught? But you wrote.
Well, I wrote my dissertation.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
By the time, it took me 9 years to get my doctorate, and by that time, the market for sociologists kind of bottomed out.
But yes. No, it's still going down, believe me.
There'd been a big spike during the late 60s and 70s, because a lot of the sort of the new left mm-hmm. and the anti-war folks had kind of streamed into sociology. Mm-hmm. Kind of turned off the spigot for any kind of government grants and stuff. So. Mm-hmm. By that time, it was just hopeless to get a position. Mm. So I finally got my doctorate. I went out home and worked on my mom's ranch for a year, just as a ranch hand. I figured years of reading and researching and writing, I thought physical labor would be just to kind of get to know my mom, kind of reestablish. I did, and then after a year out there, I came out to Seattle.
And you've been here ever since?
No. I was here in Seattle. I went up to Whidbey Island, which is north of here.
Yeah.
Again, I was trying to do some writing. Back down here and worked as a paralegal. Up down that, I got laid off. I went to Los Angeles for 4 years. Maybe for personal reasons and private family reasons, I had 92. And I've just been since here, just kind of as a.
Do you still make use of your paralegal skills?
No. I try to stay as far away as I can.
Yeah, my wife's an attorney, so I.
Well,
I know about paralegals.
I make use of the skills in the sense that's when I really started getting into computers. Mm-hmm. And writing, factual writing. And you learn stuff, office stuff, but law is not, especially when you're low down on the totem pole, it's not a, not a happy.
But, I haven't gone back to Vietnam. I'd like to sometime.
That was my next question. Do you know that Don took some IVSers back to Vietnam?
Oh yeah. Yeah. A lot of people I know have been back.
Yeah.
I'd like to go. They first started letting people in when?
In the mid 80s and late mid 80s.
They were real, real uptight and they wouldn't let you go much. But I think it's become pretty loose.
Oh, yeah, it is, much more so.
They've had, the Vietnamese government has changed in a lot of ways too. Mm-hmm. And they've been through their own sort of post war stress syndrome.
Well, they have their own Vietnam too, so yeah. Cambodia.
Well, that's, yeah. And of course, Russia collapsed, and that, I mean, the whole communist worldview just sort of lost its plausibility as a as a way of the future. And, this millennium, as everybody likes to jabber about, the great bugaboo of the 20th century, they just sort of evaporated. What some of our troubles in this country are about, not having
sort of
metaphysical
enemy.
Scapegoat.
Yes, we've had one for a long time.
Sort of this evil figure to focus on. For people in a lot of the countries that have been communist, it leaves them with kind of not quite knowing what to do either. So we're all in kind of a state of anomie right now.
Are you in touch with any other, have you ever been given money to IVS after you came back?
Yeah.
And are you on the IVS alumni list? Do you,
mm-hmm.
And did you get an alumni newsletter?
Pardon?
Do you get the newsletter?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I send them, I usually send them $100 a year. Or I'm probably being too generous with myself. I think for the past couple of years I've sent them $100 a year, which isn't that much. But and I like the fact that they're back in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And even though AIDS prevention is not really a classic kind of IVS project or developmental project, I think here's Saigon. Full of foreign businessmen, and prostitution apparently is rampant, and corruption is rife, and there are nightclubs going on that some old habitué of Saigon in the 60s would feel right at home in, and it's kind of pathetic. I mean, it's when you consider the vast amount of corruption and obsession and idealism that went into that whole struggle and, on all sides. And one of the things, when I talk about being on the national, religion for the nationalist law, I've never had visceral hatred of the Vietnamese communists or Ho Chi Minh or their program, never have. Well, it's sort of like the Chinese. I mean, remembering the era of Mao suits. Again, it's a sort of abstraction. We can project our hopes and our sort of anything that's sort of not bourgeois American. And as time goes on, and the Cultural Revolution is seen as just an appalling, totalitarian disaster. And Mao Zedong is revealed as this old roué, and there's just a lot of illusions that have been corroded, just like the illusions of sort of the Kennedy era. Go back to that era, the mindset about why we were in Vietnam and so on and so forth is is just so different. I was reading a book about Halberstam and Neil Sheehan.
Oh yeah, the young reporters in Vietnam.
Right. It's a pretty good book. You know, I think it's accurate, but the author keeps intruding and saying, "Well, there was never any reason for us ever to be in Vietnam." Well, that's just, you know, that just totally wipes out, you know,
the 25 years of history.
Well, the post-war from Truman on through Johnson and Nixon, or especially through Johnson, because he was the one that really got tangled up in it, beyond hope. But in some ways, there's no way we couldn't have gotten into Vietnam, given the most active propositions on which the top leadership was making policy at the time, partly for political reasons, but also partly, you know, out of being the superpower. Mm-hmm. And partly, you know, out of a genuine totalitarianism.
So this is Fred Abramson?
Yeah.
He was the U.S. acting USAID province advisor for your perf, SADC province.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, actually, Binh Long.
Binh Long.
Well, that was before SADC became province. But anyway, I was saying, he said flat out to me that don't let us set your agenda, because even though we're not trying to now, we will. And in that, he was right, because as there were people that were especially when CORDS came about, this mixed civilian military merged bureaucracy, and they got some real hard charges in there, and they were, some of these folks were not terribly sympathetic to folks like IVS, because we weren't with the program and we weren't really under their thumb. And all of us at some point had to deal with folks like this. A lot of them were military men who had retired or been booted out of the military for one reason or the other, and were hard charging, results oriented type folks, and that created a lot of grief. And luckily, there were people like John Paul Vann, mm-hmm. who really wasn't like that, who knew that if IVS was going to be there at all, they had to kind of do their own thing. Mm-hmm. Now, what they thought about IVS or the political function of IVS and the whole war thing is something I don't know. But there was not a rigid party line at all levels, at least where I was concerned.
I mean, not a volunteer said they were getting a helicopter ride with a colonel. And not with their opinions, because they lived amongst the people. But he's a weird bird in that he doesn't. I can see that bright shiny lie on the thing. He was a strange man.
Mm-hmm.
And but his mind was very, oh, I'd love to wear this, use this word for the tape, fact on God, he would look at things that other people wouldn't look at. And so I can see all efforts at world development and pacification.
Right.
As overall, I mean, as you think back on it, that particular effort. Except for Comer, in a couple of months, I'd love to be able to say, well, I know one guy. He's not kidding.
Well, I think it
I mean, cords came about, as far as I can recall, because the civilians and in the military were just at loggerheads and all this stuff. And the higher ups just got sick of dealing with this constant war, and they just decreed that you're going to work together, and that was it. I mean, it was one of these hammer, bureaucratic hammers that just came down, and there were people like Comer, you know, Blowtorch Bob, and these kind of people were recruited for just this kind of mission. And as I say, I do think some of the former military guys who were in a civilian capacity, but very much still in the military mode of doing things, did try to pressure IVSers to get with the program a lot more than just straight old USAID used to do. Partly because the war was not going too well, and from the American standpoint, of course. And, you know, the political pressures back in America were getting more intense all the time, and the controversy was growing, you know, all the domestic uproar was going on. And I think from a, if one were to take the perspective of the government, cords was probably necessary for them. But frankly, I don't, you know, that's kind of not my bailiwick.
You think it was potentially effective, or more effective than it was, or less effective than it could have been, just as an outside observer?
I think it was effective in the sense that it made the military and the civilians, you know, it made them work together. Mm-hmm. And so they had to plan jointly. And to some degree, maybe it gave the civilians a little bit more voice in saying, well, you know, don't send your bombers to this area because, you know, you're gonna turn these people away. You're trying to get on your side. Not that all of the military folks were that tunnel vision, but.
Well, the problem is you might be working in a certain area to develop a certain kind of program or rapport, and a cosmetic military operation through that area that had a low priority that might destroy that program.
Well,
I'm trying to think of the best spin to put on that.
I used to, like, you know, they'd come in with some minor little operation, and they'd come in with their armored personnel carriers. Mm-hmm. Into some farmer's rice field, and they just leave these horrendous gouges. Because these guys, you know, these were these young Vietnamese soldier guys, and they were kind of having fun with their equipment, and so they do these wheelies, and you know, and they just, you know, leave a big path of destruction in their way. And of course, they were thinking purely in the military side of it, and. You know, if they did damage, then that was just another casualty of war. On the other hand, you know, obviously military operations took priority over most civilian operations. And many of the civilians on the American civilians on the government side were, I know many of them were terribly frustrated, you know, but many of them didn't like the military policy, you know, the kind of more mindless military policies than anybody else did.
Well, John Balaban, they were, you know, a CIA officer, and get him up on the roof where he was burning all his personal papers, because he's writing, you know, every kind of thing that in that same district for the 2 years that you were?
No, I was in the district for a year, and then
About a month or two after Sadak became a province, I moved into the provincial capital. Partly because I didn't think I was getting that much done just on the district level, and partly because another IVSer was kind of honing in on my turf, because he was in Binglong, and so he kept kind of kept to my districts, and that kind of irked me, and you know, I just.
But now that now there's going to be a separation of the provinces.
Right.
So that that guy would handle the areas that remained in his district, which were now going to be yours, or had been yours. So moving to the provincial capital of the new district, you'd have a new territorial assignment, a different one?
Well, right. I mean, Sadak province was composed of four districts that had formerly been Binglong, all part of Binglong. And after they set up the province, then all four of those districts were considered my territory. And so the guy who was in Binglong, if he was going to come up into my territory, then we would liaison, liaise or whatever.
But since you now have four districts under one province, provincial headquarters, the best thing is to be there.
Right, right. Right. And I upgraded from a Lambretta to a Scout.
Oh, International Harvester Scout. Yes. John Paul Vann's favorite mode of travel.
Horrible vehicle. Yeah.
did your duties change? Did you take on other projects there?
Well, I got out more, and there was one district towards the south, I was pretty insecure, so I pretty much left that alone. I did expand to the three other districts, and just sort of expanded my, you know, the villages I would visit and the people I would talk to. The first year when I lived in the district, I was also teaching high school English for 2 days a week, which was okay.
You know, this would be a good time to stop if you want to have a bathroom. Can you think of the most significant thing that, or project you probably worked on in that second year?
Well, certainly the most dramatic was refugee relief after the Tet Offensive.
Okay. Well, before we get to that, now you were had you moved to that province before the Tet Offensive broke out?
Yeah.
Did you have any inkling that something was going to happen that Tet that would be different from your previous Tet?
Well, a friend of mine who was with the USAID said about 5 days before Tet, he said, well, I wonder if the Viet Cong are going to celebrate Tet this year. He had a better inkling than I did. And in fact, they made a little feint attack in Sadak City, but basically we were considered too insignificant. There were a couple bodies of 15-year-old kids out in the street that they'd sent in, which made me very young kids, and basically for nothing, just to make a noise. The big attack was down in Binglong, and the exits up here in Binglong, the capital, which is the capital province, that's down here. It's about 38 kilometers, something like that. But the roads were cut, so I sat around Sadak for about a week after Tet doing nothing, because we couldn't go out of the city. You know, everything had been clamped down for mine, and so on and so forth. So I happened to find out that the local Catholic priest was taking a boatload of supplies down to Binglong. So I said, well, I want to come with you. So I got on his little boat and covered up my head so no one could see an American. And we puttered down to Binglong. When we got fairly close to Binglong, I
uncovered my head so the U.S. Navy wouldn't shoot us up, because a lot of people were very trigger happy at that time. This was just that, but there was still stuff going on all over the place. And Vinh Long had been very badly hit. They had a huge air base there, but they had a naval, U.S. Navy. Our Navy had probably done as much damage as anybody, because they'd all gone out on the river and just shot into the city. So there were just bullet holes and really bad. And I hooked up with Mike Fairley, who was the resident IBS, old human manure, because she had gone into a Buddhist pagoda. And of course, right away the toilets had all stopped up and people were just going anywhere anyway, and the maggots got really bad and it was just appalling. So we had to shovel shit for an afternoon in the wonderful tropical heat. But that was kind of my high intensity period of actually, instead of going out to a village and talking to somebody and then coming back and trying to deal with the bureaucracy or whoever you had to deal with, and this was very high intensity, get stuff done. You'd see something that needed to get done and you'd do it, or you'd tear it somehow, or you'd get organized, the Vietnamese to get going on it. We were kind of the waste management specialist for a while. We dug latrines and got rigged latrines, got waste wood, scrap lumber to make latrines and put up partitions between them, because otherwise people would be hesitant to use them if they didn't have at least a modicum of privacy. Anything. I translated for a Navy medic who was showed up to give kids shots. We got drinking water for people. We delivered food. It was just a real tizzy situation, and basically from during the daylight hours, and then when dusk came, everything shut down again, because very spooky time. And people were still. I did that for about a week, and then I think the road had cleared. I went back to Sadak and kind of rested up, and took a bath, and Vinh Long, spent another 2-3 weeks just kind of doing whatever needed to be done. It's kind of sad in a way, because although IBS did have a strong refugee program, it was more, we were less on a kind of a crisis basis, but more on a long-term basis, doing work within kind of established refugee camps. People who had come out of areas that just, they weren't going to go back to for a long, long time. It was kind of a non-IBS thing.
Like it was just an ad hoc thing.
Except for the fact that you're there to do stuff. You're there to help people, and this was a situation where people desperately needed help in all kinds of things, and so you just did whatever the hell needed to be done. And not quite on the, the ideal person-to-person level. This was in there and see what needs to be done and get it, make sure it gets done. So it was both kind of classic IBS in one sense and kind of non-IBS in another, because we really weren't there as mop-up folks for military campaigns.
Were you, how long after Tet, how long did you stay in Vietnam after Tet?
Till September that year.
So that whole year?
Yeah.
That's the whole year, almost the whole year after Tet.
Well, my my tour officially ended in, I guess it was June or July. Well, I was trying to finish several little projects I had going.
Like?
Well, unfortunately, my big boondoggle project was an electrification project. Based on a successful project of another volunteer in another province. And he had gotten two spare generators from the Army surplus. They were about the size of what an old mainframe computer was. Mm-hmm. Huge monster, big things. And the idea was essentially to get a couple of them and cobble them together. Mm-hmm. And that had worked out quite well for him. And
do you remember who that was?
Paul, gee, big tall guy named Paul, okay, down in Sock Trung, I think, okay, it was. I can remember.
No, that's all right. That's actually enough.
By this time, I was working very closely with a village chief of one of the Waha villages. By this time, the Waha leader that I worked with had been elected to the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. So he had gone up to higher things on the national scene. So I was working quite closely with the village chief of this village, who was and he was Waha, but not part of the church establishment. And he was, progressive, hardworking, honest, kind of a model village chief. There had been an election in 67, mm-hmm, local elections, which to the rest of the world, I suppose, was just a big farce and a big cover-up for the but it was actually, in a lot of areas, it actually brought some very good local leadership, mm-hmm, to the forefront. Pretty much, yeah, because, I mean, they were under the gun, mm-hmm, to...
Yeah, they even had a constitution. I mean, it was amazing what was could have been made. I asked this of another volunteer who's more senior than you in terms of IBS. And it would have been great. He said there always seemed to be, however, something more important than national salvation to the people who were running the kind of commitment that could lead to real change to people. Mm-hmm. But that was just his opinion.
Of course, Tiu and Q were in power then. Of course, they were fighting each other all the time. And don't forget, they did have a war to fight. Mm-hmm. If there hadn't been a war going on, this would have been... if there hadn't been the war, and if the top leadership indeed had astute or less corrupt or whatever, all the problems that everybody knows about, then this would have been a very progressive kind of development. But by this time, people in America were getting so sick of the war that these kind of things, they were getting, sick of being told fibs to, and things were getting better in the light at the end of the tunnel and all that.
But what did this village chief be working with electrification there?
Right.
He came to you, you said, and you were going to...
Well, I visited this village all the time, and we just discussed things, and somehow in the course of things, I guess I might have told him about this project or something, and he just thought this was a great idea. And this was the time, too, when television was just sprouting up, mm-hmm, in Vietnam. And so that was a big status symbol, among other things. But it was, just to have electric light, there wasn't one off a little motor of a diesel generator for a whole village. That was considered a a great deal. And coming from, you know, in Montana, we had electricity because of the REA. I don't know, probably came in the 40s, but we didn't have a telephone out there until like 1956. And that kind of stuff, you know, makes a big difference in people's lives.
But you called it a boondock to get done.
Well, and again, this is an example of kind of an infrastructure thing, which theoretically, you know, has long-standing worth long after the whole rest of everything else settles out. So, in that respect, it was not a bad project.
Yeah.
So, I did all the paper. We had to get the generators from the big U.S. Army base at Long Bend, which is above Saigon. Just the most extraordinary junkyard you'll ever see. Just millions and millions of dollars worth of stuff just junked, just laying out there. Because it took too much time or too much money to fix it or do anything with it, so the military just junked it and got new stuff. Because at that time, money was no object to the military. Anybody who had any bright ideas about it, you know. So anyway, I did all the paperwork to get two generators out of the Long Bend yard, and then the village chief arranged for a truck, and I had to get security clearances for him to even be on the, you know, there was just a lot of kind of paperworky stuff, but that's how you had to get things done sometimes. So we did indeed go up in a truck he had arranged, got two generators loaded, and took them back down to the village. And then the problem was that apparently both generators had the same broken part.
Yeah.
So we couldn't really cobble them together. We couldn't, you know, cannibalize one. And just to get someone to come in and figure all this out and what parts we needed and all this, and it just took a long, long time. And so the project was still in progress by the time my time came up. I extended for 2 months because I wanted to, I thought I could get what needed to be done in that period of time. But I didn't. I didn't have enough time. So I did have a replacement who was going to come in right after I'd left. And so he sort of inherited the project. And I think much to his sorrow, because it just didn't work out. And maybe if we got four generators, it would have worked out. Or, this time the USAID folks, they were sick of dealing with it. So they'd been pretty helpful at first, and then they kind of decided not to. They had other things to worry about. So I left it unfinished when I left, and then my replacement wasn't able to.
Do you remember who that was?
Again, his name was Paul, but a different Paul.
How did you feel as your time, even your extended time, ended? How did you feel about what you've been doing?
I think very mixed motives, obviously. Wrote my final report that I felt like I succeeded as a volunteer in the sense that I hadn't harmed anybody. I hadn't harmed any Vietnamese except for hurting their feelings sometimes, which I certainly did at times. And I also felt that my effort was pretty puny and minuscule in light of the whole war and, you know, just the
vast mess it had become. I don't, you know, I guess I, my feeling was that I hadn't contributed that much since, but I think I had been a good volunteer in the sense of doing what a volunteer is supposed to do and getting along with, you know, learning the culture and living very low level, just not getting unduly entangled in the politics. But you leave with kind of a sense of futility. In September 1968, I mean, it was pretty clear that the war was not going to have a happy conclusion, from the standpoint of American policy anyway, and not the South Vietnam.
But we won the Tet Offensive.
Well, that's a very mixed picture.
How so? I'll tell you why I'm asking this question.
From the standpoint of body count, yes. You know, killing and really decimating some of the crack Vietnamese units. Purely military bases, yes. On the other hand, as politically, it broke the back of the American public's willingness to deal with Vietnam anymore, to support the war. And it was a devastating psychological, from the standpoint of psychological war, devastating to both the Americans and the South Vietnamese. Even though I remember after about, you know, a year after the Tet Offensive, I came back to Vietnam as a reporter. Mm-hmm. And there were areas in my old province that were open and flourishing that you couldn't even have gone to before. They had been, quote, pacified. So there was a pretty immense territorial regression, but it was short term. I mean, as I just said, the only thing the Viet Cong had to do was not lose the war.
Henry Kissinger said.
Yeah. Well, I think he probably borrowed it from.
Oh, I'm sure he did. Yeah. No, he wasn't claiming credit. He was saying, you know, how can you win a war when you have to fight to not lose, but, I mean, the enemy only has to fight not to lose.
Well, that was the whole Ellsberg stalemate machine business.